Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925, the first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're looking at the way labels shape our perspectives on food.
I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but is it acceptable to judge a wine by its label?
There are some labels that I'd say are so bad they're good.
As long as your paperwork's in good shape, you'll get a grass-fed label.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, and on today's episode, the queen of Seattle's post-grunge music and dining scene is Linda Dershang, and with the blessing and backing of Sub Pop's Jonathan Poneman, the Dershang Group began in 1994. First, there was Linda's Tavern on Capitol Hill. Now there are over 10 locations, from the seasonal pub Smith to two locations of the all-day Cafe Oddfellows and the Ballard Neighbor Hood Burger Joint, King's Hardware. But lately, she's been reviving Queen City, an iconic Belltown space, which has been a bar or restaurant for over 100 years. And, you know, it's that design, decor, and determination that's really defined her dynamic aesthetic for more than two decades. So welcome, Linda. Very, very happy to have you on. And I literally was just in Seattle last week and walked by a multitude of your places. Let's start about how you even got to Seattle and what the atmosphere was like pre-1994.
Well, I moved to Seattle in 1987, and I had had a clothing store in Denver, Colorado, a sort of a punk rock clothing store, selling creepers, Dr. Martens, Manic Panic, hair dye, black jeans from Trash and Vaudeville.
Can you hear that? Everyone going to their closets, pulling out all the clothes of the late 80s right now.
And I decided that it was time to leave Denver, and had friends that were touring in a band, and they told me to check out Seattle. I knew that LA, New York, San Francisco already had plenty of stores that were similar to mine. And so in January of 1987, I took a little trip to Seattle, and it was sunny and beautiful, and people were very nice. And I found a location for the store and an apartment. And it just happened. So it happened very quickly. And by May, I was already living there and had opened the store.
Can I ask which band it was that was touring? Because I feel like music's going to be a very big part of this discussion.
It was a band called The Fluid. And they ended up being on Sub Pop a few years later, maybe a year later.
So can you define, aside from the style, what punk rock meant to you at that time?
I think it started hanging around the punk rock, and, you know, and it was also new wave scene in Denver in the early 80s. And I was, taking art classes in college, and I started working at a record store called Wax Trax, and waiting tables. And so I think it was, just finding my people, finding, probably some young and a little angry at times, friends, but just also creative people that were living a different way than that I had been exposed to before, even though it was Denver, the Denver punk rock scene, you know, and started going like to San Francisco to see the Cramps play, because there were bands that didn't actually make it to Denver. Once I drove with a group of friends to Chicago to see Bauhaus and turned around and drove back the next day.
In my college years, I certainly made those drives. And there is something about music that is so magnetic that you're willing to take that trip. And it's crazy to think that food is in a similar vein nowadays. People are willing to drive for miles, jump on planes to see that restaurants. And I constantly hear that chefs are the new rock stars. But you've seen these two paths, not necessarily parallel, music prior to food. When did these two things converge for you?
Well, let's see. In 92, Sub Pop had gone from a scrappy, sometimes broke record label to, but, you know, they probably became fairly well known, what was it, about around 1990. But by 92, you know, Nirvana had had become successful, very successful.
Yeah. And aside from Nirvana, I hate to say this and admit this in front of you, wasn't a huge Nirvana fan.
What?
Yeah, and I mean, I appreciate them, but I was a Mudhoney fan.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Touch Me, I'm Sick is one of my top five favorite songs.
But between those two and Soundgarden, there was a specific type of, you know, sound coming out of Seattle. Mm-hmm. Did that pair with a specific type of mentality like punk rock did in Denver at the time?
Oh, I think, yeah, definitely. And so, you know, when I moved to Seattle, I just, of course, gravitated towards, you know, the same sort of social life and friends that I had in Denver, which was, you know, people that were involved in music and art and people that owned small businesses, a little coffee shop, you know, a little record store, a skateboard shop. And then, obviously, the Sub Pop, a little record label that became a big record label.
The modern bands that are on the label now, I think, are like Sleater-Kinney. Not that they're new, but Sleater-Kinney, Fleet Foxes. I think Postal Service was on them for a while, if not still. Mm-hmm. How has Sub Pop evolved in the same way that Seattle has?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that Sub Pop has stayed for many, many, many years. Over what, I guess this summer was the 30-year anniversary. A really well-known independent record label, and they're still really successful. And I think that that's something definitely to be applauded.
Well, how do you use that? I don't know what the word is, but how do you use that arc of having existed and changed, but still represented the same kind of ethos, to owning a restaurant group?
Well, it's tricky. Let's see. Well, I guess I'll tell you a little of my path. I started with this little dive bar called Linda's Tavern that in February will be 25 years old. And right after that, Jonathan Poneman said, gosh, this has been really great. Let's do something else. I said, wait, hold on. This has only been a few months. Give me a little more time with this. But within a couple years, we opened another place, and about 6 months later, another place. And so suddenly I had three businesses, close to 100 employees, and I felt like I was juggling all these balls in the air, because I know it sounds a little ridiculous to think, how could she not think what it would be like to run a company that big? But I was just kind of winging it. And, you know, one of my mottos in life is, why not? You know, let's just do this. So
right before the show, we were talking about how you had never worked in you had waited tables, but you had never been a bartender before.
Right.
And when you opened up Linda's Tavern, you called that discipline beer tending.
Right.
So what is on the job, like OTJ learning, like in this industry?
Well, I mean, there definitely was a lot to learn. I think the biggest thing for anyone that ends up owning a business is managing people, right? How do you get people to do what they're supposed to do and want to do it and create a really good culture around that? And, you know, it can be a steep learning curve.
How many employees do you have now?
A little over 200.
How many locations do you have now?
Six.
How hard is it to delegate? How hard is it not to be the one in, I mean, maybe ultimate control, but be in day-to-day control of things?
I would say early on it was hard. I definitely I was a bit of a micromanager, and I think that's common. But the older I get, the easier I find it to, you know, let things go and let other people handle them. And I'm really blessed with an amazing team of people around me.
You could speak their names.
Oh.
Please, because, you know, it does take a village to be able to, you know, have a village of restaurants in Seattle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can go through the list again and say, you know, that the Smith is a seasonal pub and Oddfellows is an all-day cafe and Tallulah's was a veggie-forward restaurant. But that doesn't really define the spirit of who or what those places are. It's the who in those places.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, a manager at Oddfellows worked at a business I sold years ago in the late 90s, and then another business that that I sold a few years after, or a few years after that, and left and went and worked for a few different restaurants, and then came back to work for our company about, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago. And I just think that it's so wonderful that she was with us for a while, left, and came back, and hopefully will be with us for many, many years. I have employees that have been with me for 10, 15 years. And, you know, I think that being surrounded by the right people just makes all the difference in anything that we do.
In reading about you, in profiles that I had seen in The Stranger and in Seattle Magazine, is I really thought you would be a people person. You are very much a people person, but you are a people person in a way that I don't see often in restaurants, whereas, you know, there's the people person that kind of like breezily comes in, rubs elbows, says hey, but you're really ingrained in everything and everyone, and you care about this community wholeheartedly, like, you know, people care about music. You know, how bandmates have to be able to play with each other to not, you know, be dissonant. Let's talk about that culture, because I think that's something that can get lost within expansion and franchising and having as many places. How do you hold true to, you know, what you do in one place versus, you know, 10 plus?
Well, I think the common thread is for each one of the businesses I've opened, including the clothing stores, is that they're places I want to go to, and I'm, you know, sort of assuming that my friends want to go to also. We like to say that we don't create them for everyone, but everyone is welcome. And I think that if you are trying to create something that is for everyone, it, you know, sometimes you're kind of watering something down. But and something that I'm really proud of is that we do have a really diverse clientele in all of the businesses. And since, if you've been in Oddfellows, you know, it's from, you know, just whether it's doctors at a nearby hospital to, there's two colleges nearby, moms and their kids, to all sorts of musicians and artists that are living and working in the neighborhood. So I think walking into one of my businesses and seeing all sorts of people having a really good time is one of the most satisfying things. And you're right, I do. I really do like people. I'm the sort of person who walks in a room and just assumes I'm going to like most people. And I think, to me, that's a really nice way to move through life.
Yes, and especially today, we need that kind of optimism and caring.
Oh, my God. Do we ever?
We'll end this episode and then up no, a crescendo. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enameled cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Not only because I use it constantly, but because cabinet space is at a premium in New York City kitchens. My boyfriend and I were gifted our Le Creuset by his family last Christmas, and it was the first piece of enameled cookware we'd ever owned. I'd been fawning over the marine blue color, especially when I realized there were only a few left in stock. When we unwrapped the box, we were pleasantly surprised to see how big this thing was. I immediately started imagining what I could cook. Roast chicken, Texas-style chili, a leg of lamb, or my favorite, a huge batch of Marcella Hazan's bolognese. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN. That's LECREUSET.com/HRN to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Michael Harlan Turkell here today with Linda Dershang, who, you know, is Linda's an eponymous tavern? Like, did you name it after yourself?
I didn't. Bruce Pavitt was the one who suggested it. Jonathan said, yeah, great. And I said, well, why not?
Yeah. I mean, do you think you would have done, I mean, you've done very, very well with that, but if you had called it Dershang's.
I wouldn't have. No one would be able to pronounce it.
I mean, now you could do that. Now people would not only find it quirky, but there is that, you know, relatability to who you are and what you've done in Seattle.
Right.
So maybe, you know, I'm just saying, I'd go to Dershang's.
I think early on people thought of it as sort of the Sub Pop bar for the first maybe 6 months or something.
I would have never related Sub Pop to a giant buffalo head. So let's talk about how it is and isn't a Sub Pop bar from a decor and design standpoint. Because what did you want it to look like?
Well, because I had... I'd spent time in Colorado, in the mountains, going to mountain bars and, you know, ski towns. I definitely was trying to think of the parts of a dive bar that really make it feel good. And when you're building something new rather than taking over an old bar, how do you design it in a way that it doesn't look like a theme bar, right? How does it feel sort of authentic and... which wasn't probably a word that I would have used then in 1993 for when we were getting it ready to open. But we were just thinking of all the things that make dive bars cool, you know. So they're dark and cozy, and there's booths and low lighting, and things can't be too matchy-matchy. They have to look a little bit found, right?
It has to be worn. Like, it has to be, you know... reclaimed wood. We were even joking about this during the break that, you know, you were very, very ahead of the curve of using reclaimed wood. Was it out of necessity, out of economics, or aesthetic?
Aesthetic. It was, we use salvage wood. We use some logs that we definitely had to find the right color, this sort of honey color varnish on them, so they looked a little aged. Old paintings, wagon wheel lights, old signs. And I found an old cupboard that had come out of a drugstore in an area of town called Pioneer Square, and we used that as a cupboard instead of building out a cupboard for some liquor storage. And at the time, it just made sense to give the look that we were looking for. Somebody once said that it was like I was designing stage sets more than in interiors. And at first I wasn't sure that I liked that. And over time I've grown to think of it like that, because really you're trying to set a mood. You know, in any place that you go that isn't really old but you're trying to give it a feeling that maybe it's been around for a while, you have to use some salvage materials to give that feeling.
And then there's the jukebox, where Linda's was very much about the music when it began. What is it about now?
Well, the music is still important, and there's still a lot of musicians that work at Linda's and always have. It's always had a connection to our local music scene. We try to keep the jukebox super eclectic. Bruce Pavitt says that he would like us to always have the Ramones in the jukebox.
As a New Yorker, I like that, yes.
We're all good with that. We all love the Ramones. So, but yeah, they're definitely... Linda's started out with a strong connection to music, but it's continued through the years.
This is a funny question, but having played in punk and emo bands, I was vegan and vegetarian during those times. Mm-hmm. What do musicians eat?
Well, I suppose it depends on the musician, just like anyone else. I think that when bands are out touring, that there are the people that are really interested in food and are looking for the best, whether it's taco or soup dumplings or, you know, burger. It could be anything. I have a friend that said that he would go to different cities and try to find those sorts of things. And, but you know, I'm sure that there are plenty of musicians that are clean and healthy eaters. A few vegans like you were.
But how do you create a place that's both neighborhoody as well as a destination? So, say people are coming to Seattle, rather than just it being for people that live in that general vicinity, how, from a bar standpoint, food standpoint, design standpoint, do you draw people into all of your locations?
Well, funny enough, these days at Odd Fellows, which is our all-day, all-night neighborhood cafe, about to be 10 years old, it is the most Instagrammed restaurant in Washington State. And the main area that's Instagrammed, it's Instagram moment, I think that sometimes it's known as, is an old flag hanging on the wall. Odd Fellows opened in December of 2008. So when I was looking for odds and ends to decorate it towards the end of the project, I came across an old flag. And at that time, what happened in November of 2008? Obama had just been elected. And when I saw that flag, I thought, you know what? It's time to hang a flag. We were all so excited about Obama. But funny enough, it is the thing that is the most Instagrammed, but there was no Instagram then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I hope that sentiment, especially today, comes back and we have, you know, the same feeling that we did in 2008, not the...
Well, we'll see what happens later today,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
If we have a little hope.
We do, but back onto the food and bar front, how do you change something that has been an institution for so long? I mean, it sounds like I'm asking a political question, but I'm referring to Queen City, which is an iconic Belltown space, and it's been in the community for over 100 years as a bar restaurant. How do you ingratiate yourself into taking over a space that people know?
Well, that was an interesting one because I've never done that before. And, you know, previous to the Queen City Grill, which opened in 87, it was a place called Queen City Tavern. And I've heard from some people that are a little older than I am that have been in recently that it was quite a place. I mean, it was a super dive. And a place that they would go, you know, late at night after they'd already been out partying. And then it shut down in 1984. In 87, the Queen City Grill opened, and it was way, way more upscale. And I think that's the one that a lot of people have memories of. I don't, however. I didn't go there all that frequently, maybe a dozen times. So interestingly, I didn't have this nostalgic feeling about it that sort of slanted my view of what I wanted it to be. I live in that neighborhood, and I knew that I wanted a neighborhood hangout. And there were others that I had been talking to that live and work down there that felt the same way. And I knew that it had already been sold once after it had been the Queen City Grill, reopened by a new owner just for the last year or so, and I knew that they weren't doing really well. So I had hoped that if I was able to get it and take it over, that people would actually be very happy about that because they didn't want to see the place just, you know, completely shut down. So because the previous owners had made some changes that I think a lot of people weren't fond of, I really got a pass. they had painted it all white, so I painted it... I made it just sort of moody and dark and painted the ceiling a dark gray. And, you know, I think, and made it cozy again. And so people would walk in and say, oh my God, this has that same sort of feeling. It didn't look exactly the same as the one that they remembered, but it has the feeling. I don't know if they could have told you what color the walls had been back in 1995 when they loved it.
So in other words, if a place has, you know, good bones, yep, you don't go in there and gut it.
No, and that was part of my draw with this, is that it had really, really good bones. In fact, somebody told me that the bar itself, it was had been there since like the 1930s. And so it was fun to have to take over a place that did have really good bones, and also a lot easier than building out a brand new place, to just give a great place a light kind of redo, hang a little taxidermy, a few portraits, some of the, you know, a few rock photos, and call it a day.
Let's talk about one last thing, and it's about you being a female entrepreneur, because
mm-hmm.
I think it's such a strong part of your personality. Obviously, you know, you are female, but supporting other females in the industry as well. What was it like in 1994 opening up Linder's Tavern versus being a woman in the industry now?
Oh my God, it is so different. There were hardly any, if any, other bar owners in 1994. And the first few weeks that Linda's Tavern was open, the beer reps didn't want to sell me beer. So they would sell me one keg at a time, one case of, say, Budweiser, one case of something else. So I kept running out of beer. And I thought, after having a clothing store where they're like, are you sure you don't want two dozen of this? When I would come to New York on a buying trip, paying cash, beer really doesn't go bad. So why wouldn't they want to sell me two or three kegs of something? Why only one? So for the first few weeks, I would have to call every day and go, please, please send me another beer delivery. I'm going to run out of beer. I don't know exactly why they were doing that. It ended after about 3 weeks. But I have heard since that it wasn't happening to men that owned bars. At that time also, because there weren't other women that I knew in that industry, I mean, that were owners in that industry, you know, it was definitely hard. There were some men that were very, very helpful, but, you know, there were a lot of other men, especially because Linda's became very, very popular fast, that I felt that I needed to keep my cards very close when I was talking to them. And in the last probably 15 years, I have been delighted to find so many women opening businesses and to have so many women friends in business. And many of my friends in business are at least 10 years younger, and some are 20 and 25 years younger. And, you know, I learn a lot from them. I mean, I've got friends like Rachel Marshall from Rachel's Ginger Beer, Carrie Brunson from Frankie and Joe's, Angela Stoll, who was the CEO of Ethan Stoll Restaurants, who's now at Fair Start, Linda Morton from Terra Plata, and Tamara Murphy. I mean, amazing women around, and amazing women doing things in the community. But having their support and friendship is so important. I look back at what it was like, and it's just a world of difference.
Well, you were a big part of making that world cozy and comfortable and accepting and diverse. So, you know, a lot of gratitude towards you. If there were parting words to give to anybody trying to be a restaurant owner, bar owner in this day and age, man, woman, any race, gender, etc., what would it be?
Words of advice. Plan on spending a lot of time there. And honestly, better like people. I actually have had a few friends that have opened bars and realized they don't want to be around people all the time. And also really want to be in your business and with your employees. I do think it's interesting how often people really love the idea of opening a business, but they don't really think about what it will be like to work in that business. And that's different than, say, a chef opening his restaurant. He's used to working in the restaurant. It's more people coming from the outside thinking, wouldn't it be cool to have a bar? Wouldn't it be cool to have a restaurant? Because, you know, my grandma has a really great fried chicken recipe, right? And they really don't know the industry. But again, I didn't know the industry, and here I am.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you took that risk. And in the same way that, you know, Seattle isn't all rain and fog, as most people think. There are certainly rays of sunshine. Thank you again for being on The Food Scene. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thank you to La Crusade for sponsoring, music by Cookies, and Matt Patterson Engineering. And one little last announcement. Tickets are now on sale for our Winter in the Garden holiday party and tasting. This is Monday, December 3rd, in the Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. Starts at 6 p.m. for VIPs, 7 for general admittance. Whole bunch more information at heritageradionetwork.org/gala. Check it out. I'm going to be making really, really good grilled cheeses, caviar. Yeah, stop by my station for sure. But thank you again to Le Creuset, Linda, for being on the show, and everyone involved here at Heritage Radio. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.